The Bastards of Boston Baseball Podcast.
Back to Folk. Red Sox fans have longed to hear it. The Boston Red Sox are world champion. Game over, series over, and the Red Sox are world champs again.
Yes, indeed. Here it comes. Another edition of the Bastards of Boston Baseball.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another edition of the Bastards of Boston Baseball. I said at the close of our last show, I didn't believe we would be back before Sunday, but Jordan Montgomery gave us a reason. He has finally signed. The long wait is over. Whether we were hoping for him to sign is like probably 90% of us were. And then everyone else, we just wanted the saga to end. Finally, it does. He will go to the Diamondbacks on a one-year guaranteed deal for $25 million. There is a vesting option for a second year. It's pretty easy to trigger. He only needs to make 10 starts. They can all be duds, and he's going to get $25 million from the Diamondbacks, for a second year if he does make those 10 starts. So, I also said it might have been two or three shows ago, I expected it could be as low as a two-year deal. I can't remember if you were on that show, Micah, or not. Jason Kelly was with me. He thought it'd be about a three-year deal, which of course was very plausible. But it does end up being a wonky two-year deal. So Micah, thanks for joining. Go ahead. Give us the initial take.
Well, I'm super excited for opening day tomorrow. I love this time of the year, but at the same time, the fact that Jordan Montgomery was still out there 2 days before opening day and the fact that the Red Sox didn't get him, it's just frustrating. I probably was one of the biggest, bring Jordan Montgomery to Boston. I was on that train, I was in that fan club, whatever you want to call it. That was who I wanted the Red Sox to get. And everyone kept saying, like, he's not coming to Boston. And I agree. Once Sam Kennedy kind of made those comments in spring training of how the organization kind of was going to have a little bit of a cap, a self-imposed cap, it was pretty obvious that it really didn't look like they were going to go anywhere near that luxury tax threshold. And it's not that I didn't really believe they were going to sign him. But there was no reason they didn't sign him. That was a slam dunk move. The national reporters were just constantly saying the Red Sox and Montgomery it was a natural fit. And I really do believe that if the Red Sox had shown some type of an aggressive offer, they would have gotten him. Because, he took a one-year deal. No one expected that when the offseason started. No one would have ever predicted that. So it's mind-boggling that the Red Sox are just not interested in building a competitive team, not even a winning team, just a competitive team. Like, Jordan Montgomery would have made them much more competitive this season. And what I don't understand is it's been long reported that John Henry does not like giving pitchers who are 30 or over large contracts. And the ones he's given out haven't really worked. The David Price contract didn't work out well at all. But he had an opportunity to get a number two on this Red Sox current staff. He'd be probably the ace, but a number two, a quality starter. For 1 year, there was zero commitment needed other than just this year. And they couldn't top it. And that's so frustrating. Like, yeah, $25 million would have put him over the luxury tax by like $2 million. But if the season didn't work out the way they had hoped, they could have cut bait on a couple of their players, probably Jordan Montgomery at one of them, and they could have gotten underneath the luxury tax before the season ended. But there was zero willingness to go out and add and make this team a competitive roster. And it's just frustrating. You know, I don't think this team is god awful, but they need stability in the rotation. And Jordan Montgomery was that guy. So super frustrating. I'm a little surprised he signed, because if he would have waited two more days for when the season started, he would not have a qualifying offer attached to him. So, you know, now if he decides to come back and he declines his vesting option, then the qualifying offer is attached to him, and that's going to make him even harder next offseason to sign because of that qualifying offer. So just super frustrating. You know, if you're the Red Sox, why not sign him and then give him the 1 year deal? He opts out, and then you get a pick next year. Like, that just that makes so much sense in my brain with how they're trying to operate. But I guess nothing makes sense with what this front office is doing. Just frustrating, because he was right out there for the taking.
Or better yet, sign him and then trade him at the deadline and get under the cap that way. You know, somebody would have taken him. The Rangers did last year. I think Boris used the qualifying offer, that angle, be like, well, you know, if he waits four more days to sign, a lot more teams are going to be interested. So I think he used the qualifying offer to get that vesting option, which is going to very easily trigger. I think that's how the Diamondbacks got him. He wasn't supposed to go to a small market team. From the outset, he was supposed to go to a big market team and help them win a World Series, much like he did the Texas Rangers, who are a big market team. But so to touch on a few things here, Micah, you had a take on Yamamoto long before he ended up signing. And you said, if he ends up signing for only $250 million and the Red Sox weren't even close, I would lose my freaking mind. And if I would have told you on that same night that Jordan Montgomery would only sign a 1 year guaranteed deal, or you can even say it's a 2 year guaranteed deal for $50 million. Same thing. I'd lose my mind. Why aren't the Red Sox in on that? And I'm not mad that they didn't sign him. I'm mad that they never had any intentions to sign him, because they would have. They would have matched that offer. If they match that offer, he comes to Boston because his wife is here and is going to be here for a couple years. So all the Red Sox had to do with Montgomery was match the best offer, and they didn't do it. And another red flag to me, see, some people give the angle, and I can't completely dismiss this, but some people might say, well, maybe they were in on him, and then when Giolito went down, they lost interest, because then it became pointless. And I think it kind of sort of does become pointless for 2024. Like, I was assuming at that point he was still getting at least 3 or 4 years the day we heard the Giolito news. So my thought was, well, it's a signing for 2025 through 2027. Next year, you're going to wish Jordan Montgomery was on the market, and he probably won't be. But the one thing that I keep going back to, though, was the Shota Imanaga deal. When he signed for $14 million a year for only three guaranteed years, he's got a weird contract. I guess there's two options that trigger somehow. I didn't go back and look it up. But he's only got 3 years guaranteed, $14 million a year, so 42 overall. When the Red Sox weren't in on him at that price, that's a red flag to me. That should have been a red flag that they were never going to go get Montgomery. They already had Giolito at that time, who was presumed to be healthy. So Imanaga could have been that second piece, and they didn't go get him. So there were plenty of telltale signs along the way, but I'm frustrated. I think we're in for a terrible season. I don't think this starting rotation is sustainable. And I think the back end is questionable too. Chris Martin is not going to have a 1.08 ERA again. It's probably going to be triple that. You're hoping for the best with Jansen. He's not probably not going to be terrible, but he's going to be a 36-year-old ninth inning guy. I just don't, there's not a lot of sustainability here. And I think the offense is more flawed than some people think as well.
Yeah, it's so frustrating because, like you said, if you would, when we were talking our prediction show for the offseason, I mean, we were discussing, would you be willing to do 6 years on him? Like, that's where we were talking. And, you know, 4 months later or 5 months later, it's, you know, 1/6 of that ends up being the deal. And it's like, how do you not jump at that? There is zero risk in that contract. Zero. I mean, he could do what Lucas Giolito did, and it's no big deal. You know what I mean? Because it's a one-year deal. And it's just I'm with you. I don't see specifically Whitlock and Houck being sustainable. Do I think they could be better than they were last year? I do. I think Andrew Bailey could help either one of them, maybe both of them. But I just don't think for 162, even Cutter Crawford, I think there is some concern in terms of him getting through the season because he kind of wore down last year when he made 25 or 26 starts. So the last three guys in the rotation, just there's a lot of question marks, and Montgomery would have really eased a lot of concerns with that. You know, you could have moved Whitlock or Houck into the bullpen and kept them kind of stretched out into a 3 or 4 inning role if you wanted to do that. And then if somebody goes down, you have somebody where you go, you know what, at least we have Houck or Whitlock to back them up. But now you have nothing. There's just such little depth, and it doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I'm super frustrated because I really think if Montgomery's on this team, I think projections really change. I think instead of mid-70s wins, you're probably thinking upper 70s. Maybe they crack 81, 82. You know, Montgomery would have probably kept them in contention around the trade deadline, and then we get back to what are we doing? You know, are we in or are we out? I think that would have at least been in a discussion. Without Montgomery, I don't think that's a discussion. I think it's very clear how this front office is going to operate. There's no way they're going to add, even if they have a stellar first 3 or 4 months where they're in contention. This team is by no means going to buy. There's no way. There's no way they're going to do it. They're going to subtract, and they're going to keep building for the future. And it's just like Jordan Montgomery could have been a build for the future type of move. You know, 3 or 4 year deal. I think all of us would have signed up for, you know, 4 and 80 or 4 and 90, something like that at the beginning of the offseason. We've been like, that's a great deal. A little overpay because of the postseason, but okay, 4 and 80, 4 and 90. But 1 and 25? You know, and I think the front office is to really blame for this because it's clear they have a spending limit. But I do think now that the offseason is officially over with Montgomery signing, you have to look back, and the money that Craig Breslow was allowed to spend, he spent $19 million on Lucas Giolito, who was, and I'm not even saying the fact that he got Tommy John surgery, because that was an unknown, but there was a lot of risk. I think you stated that a couple weeks ago on the pod, that there was a lot of risk signing Lucas Giolito. And he gave $19 million for a very risky pitcher when he could have paid $25 million, hindsight 2020, for Jordan Montgomery. Like, who would you rather have, even if Giolito was healthy? Like, I'd rather have Jordan Montgomery based on what we saw last year. That's pretty easy to me. So I just, hindsight 2020, like, you do have to grade Breslow off the work he's done. And, you know, signing Giolito for that, and then you see what Montgomery went for, even Sonny Gray, what he went for, that you brought up Imanaga. Like, it's just he jumped early on some of the moves, and I think the value, based on how the offseason played out, some teams got really good value for players as the offseason went on.
you know, you said we're not going to be buyers at the deadline, and we're not. Not in terms of major league ready, proven talent type people. But what do you have for trade capital? You got maybe Jaren Duran, I guess. I'd hate to get rid of him, but he could be dealt. You've got your two back end of the bullpen guys who nobody wanted this winter. I mean, you got Nick Pivetta as well. But none of them, you're not going to get the next big stud prospect with any of them. It's just not going to. It's not going to happen. So I think by having a dud of a winter, you're going to have a dud of a July. You're going to get a lot of lottery ticket type moves. You'll get another Richard Fitz type guy from another guy's system. It's not going to be anybody super sexy. I mean, maybe you'll hit on something, but we're not going to get like a major haul for any of them. I want to get to a Breslow quote. I was trying to get it on my laptop, but I logged myself out. Now I don't remember my password, so I'm gonna use.
Can I respond to what you just said?
Yep.
So I agree with you. Unless they were to package, like, if they would have packaged Jansen and Martin last year, I think they could have probably got a really good piece in return, because you could transform a team's bullpen by adding two of those pieces. So like maybe that's the way they get a piece. But I mean, they did trade back in, what was it, 2020? They traded two relievers. I'm blanking on his name, to the Phillies for Pivetta and Sewald. And it's like, so I think it was Workman and who the heck was the other?
Heath Hembree. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like, I guess you could in theory hit on somebody, but like you said, I don't think they're getting anybody's top, you know, five prospects with anything, unless they were to package somebody together. I'm with you. Montgomery would have been a great trade chip, especially with how he just performed in October this past year.
Yeah. And I want to get to a Breslow quote here. So it's actually two quotes. This is on December 4th, which was either during the winter meetings or just before them. This is what Breslow said. We're going to be as aggressive as we can. Excuse me. Let me start over. I can't read tonight. Breslow says, we're going to be as aggressive as we possibly can to fill the rotation. Everything is on the table as it relates to improving this team. That was the first week of December. Here's the next quote. This was only 4 days ago. Breslow says, there's also wanting to give the guys that we have here a chance to establish themselves. It's believing in what we have and maybe even more than what others might believe outside the doors of this clubhouse. So we're trotting out Heim Bloom's rotation that we all agreed was nowhere near good enough, nowhere near sustainable, as I essentially pointed out in the open. And that's the quote. I mean, you could just change the name from Breslow to Bloom, and that's something Bloom might have said last June or July. And again, you know, John Henry is a big part of the problem here, but I don't want to be fed crap like that. I don't even appreciate that, you know, where Breslow is essentially the messenger. We're done with that. We don't want to hear that anymore. And I was thinking today earlier, every team that's gone through a rebuild, and every year there's five or six of them doing it, every team that has ever done it has been transparent about that going into year one of the rebuild, saying, all right, you know, don't expect a lot here. We're working hard to rebuild this team and it's going to take some time and we need you to be patient, but trust the process. Believe us. We're going to put together a powerhouse. That's not what the Red Sox are saying year in and year out. They haven't been honest about it. And, you know, you've seen defiance from Sam Kennedy, basically criticizing Red Sox fans at one point this winter. We're not going to take that. We're not going to take that. The narrative that flip-flops every few weeks with this organization, it's frustrating. As a Red Sox fan the last 5 years, you're just trying to make sense of what's going on day to day, week to week, month to month. And at the end of it, it just doesn't make sense. I said on social media last night, when they traded Mookie, it was to make the team better. It was a move that would ultimately make sense. And 4 years later, it still doesn't make sense. And I don't care that they traded him necessarily. I didn't want to give him that massive deal. But, and admittedly, it's worked out very well. I mean, he was, I think, MVP runner-up last year or close to it.
So far.
So far. The back end is not going to work, but I don't appreciate being lied to. I don't appreciate the plan not coming together, not being executed. We still got no pitching prospects outside of back end of the rotation type guys. That's all we've got. And now, you know, targeting top free agents, like I said yesterday, it's strictly forbidden. This, I say all the time, and I'm going to say it a million times this year, this is the Great Depression of Red Sox baseball. That's what this is. And you mentioned David Price and Chris Sale and all the long-term guys that have burnt us, and it's been most of them. There's a phobia about signing those long-term guys, and now I think there's a phobia about spending any money whatsoever in pitching. It's all about development. That's the only system they seem to trust now, and you can't do that. I mean, you go to this Diamondbacks rotation where Montgomery's joining. They do have a few homegrown guys. I mean, Merrill Kelly was signed, I think, out of Japan after pitching there for 3 or 4 years. I'll consider him to be homegrown at that point. Zach Galen, I think he was traded to the Diamondbacks in a 1-for-1 deal. Do you know who the player the Marlins got back?
Christian Walker. I have no idea.
It was Jazz Chisholm. So it was a good trade.
That's a good trade for both sides.
Yeah, the Marlins just didn't do their job outside of that trade, basically. But and then Brandon Pfaadt is a homegrown guy. But there's still going to be two guys in there. And I think I've always been an E-Rod apologist. I really have. But I think this is going to be a great rotation and a great market for E-Rod to just relax, do his thing, and everybody else around him are going to be doing their things. I wouldn't be surprised if Brandon Pfaadt becomes the ace of this staff in a year or so. Last year was his rookie year. And
he was one of the top pitching prospects going into last year. I think he was like a top 10 or 15 pitching prospect around the league. So like the hype around him, and if you watched him in the postseason, he had some moments.
He had a short leash, but got away with it. He kind of got out of some jams, was kind of bailed out. But as the playoffs went on, it just seemed like the trust increased. And I think he had at least one or two 5 or 6 inning outings as they got late. And that's amazing. I remember going into the 2007 World Series, and I was talking to my friends, and one of them said, he goes, if we lose a game, it's going to be the Lester game in Game 4. And then we'll get him back in Game 5 and we'll end it. And John Lester was a postseason god for us, basically. And then for the Cubs later on as well. So I could just see Pfaadt, you know, becoming another John Lester type guy. It's crazy. And you know, we're off to the slaughterhouse for the third year in a row. But what does this do for the Diamondbacks? I already had them comfortably as a wild card team before the Montgomery signing. Do you think they can take the division? It's the best rotation in the division, I think.
I think it's probably the most, like, I feel like you know what you're getting with that rotation. There is a lot of uncertainty with the Dodgers. And I think if the Giants had Robbie Ray at the start of the year, I think that would be an interesting rotation as well. But I would agree. I think the Diamondbacks probably have the most sure thing of a rotation. I don't know how long Erod is supposed to be out. He has a lat strain or an oblique strain, one of those two. I think they had said a month or two potentially. So that could be something they have to work through. I mean, but they have the depth. Jordan Montgomery gives them the depth to work around an injury like that. So I don't know if they can necessarily compete with the Dodgers for a division title, because I think the Dodgers are probably heading towards a 95 to 100 plus win season. Can the Diamondbacks win 95? I mean, we saw what they were in the world, in the playoffs and in the World Series, but they just squeaked in last year. Like, but I think they won like 83 games. So is this roster significantly better than last year's team? I think it's good. I think it's better. I just don't know if it's significantly better. Is it 5 wins better than last year? Are they at 88 or are they at 90? I just don't know if it's like 15 wins better than last year's team. I don't know. That might be a big ask to jump up that much to be in the Dodgers. Because I think you're going to – when you talk about the Dodgers, you're probably talking about a 95 to 100 win team. So can the Diamondbacks get into that type of territory, stratosphere, when you also have the Giants in the division? Because the Giants are going to be I think the Giants are easily a playoff team. I think they're right in the conversation. And then I would say probably the other playoff team comes the other two wild card teams probably come from the NL East would be my guess.
Yeah, I've got the Giants, Dodgers, and Diamondbacks all in there, and then the Phillies being the other one. Yep. I couldn't come up with two central teams. I had the Cubs I had going. That was a tough division, probably one of the hardest to pick.
Yep, I agree.
Yeah. I guess the thing to look out for here with the Diamondbacks is they could be aggressive at the deadline. They're not going to need pitching, most likely. And you mentioned Eduardo Rodriguez. He already began his throwing program today. So that tells me probably no more than a month. And the key words in Torrey Lovello's interview the other day was that they dodged a bullet, they think. So that, again, gave me optimism that perhaps it's just going to be a short thing. I mentioned John Lester earlier. He had a lat strain and missed about a month one season.
But again, they were expecting to have Erod, but no Montgomery. So like they were preparing to go with a rotation like they had. So you're essentially swapping out Erod and putting Montgomery in that spot for the first month of the season, and then you add Erod to the rotation. I mean, Eduardo Rodriguez might be their number 4. Like, that's really, really good.
And like, he's a postseason pitcher too. He's a big game pitcher.
Yeah.
And he had a gem going in game 4 of the 2018 World Series. That was in Dodger Stadium. That was when Cora kind of left him hung out to dry there in the 7th inning. Probably shouldn't have
his glove.
shouldn't have let him face Puig again. But he just thrives in the moment. So, and I did say on the last show, even if they're not built to win the division, I definitely think they could be built for October. And that's a difference. When you take the one game wild card out of it, because it's 2 out of 3 now, I think that's manageable. And the X factor for me, like I said, with their rotation is Brandon Pfaadt. If he's a stud this year, I mean, it's not – Erod and Montgomery are just a bonus at that point, because Galen's going to be good. Merrill Kelly, I don't know if he's going to be quite as good as last year, but he's certainly going to be, highly serviceable. Quite frankly, a guy I'd love to have. But you know, and he's like 35, 36 years old, by the way. He was drafted, I think, in 2014 and, or maybe even earlier than that. I think he last pitched, in the MLB, in 2014 and then went away for 4 years. Some of that was across the Pacific, but man, this is just so good. Did the Diamondbacks, I'm going to check right now if they, I know they re-signed Gurriel.
They also added Eugenio Suarez. They made a trade with the Mariners.
Okay. Yeah, he's kind of an all or nothing power guy, but yep. not a bad piece. And I think he's a pretty good defender. Yeah, I mean, they're not looking that bad. I mean, Ketel Marte, quietly, you know, one of the better middle infielders in MLB. Christian Walker at first.
He's a legit power bat.
Yeah. And then their outfield, Gurriel. This is serviceable. I don't know if they, I'm not familiar with their farm, so I don't know. Oh, you know who they got too? This, well, at least against righties, it's going to be good. Jock Peterson. Yeah. So,
and he's a big time performer in the playoffs.
Comfortably, I'll say that they'll win 90, barring no injuries. I think they'll win 90, and
I think that puts them in second place in that division. I that would be my guess. I don't see a scenario where the Dodgers don't just steamroll a lot of the teams. Like, could the Diamondbacks and Padres compete with them? Yeah. But no one else in that division is competing with them. I don't see many teams in the NL Central competing with them. And the NL East, it's really the Phillies and Braves. And then the Marlins, Nationals. And who's the fourth team I'm missing? Oh, my God. This isn't good. It's almost open.
In the East?
Yeah.
Braves, Marlins. Phillies, Mets, Marlins. Mets,
the Mets. Yeah, the Mets, okay. Mets aren't very good. So, I don't know. I think the Dodgers are going to win a lot of games just based on their offense. I think their offense is elite.
I'd give the Mets a better chance to make the postseason than the Padres. I think the Padres are only going to win 77, 78 games.
Have you seen the Mets starting rotation?
It's not good, and I know Senga is injured. But I mean,
Jose Quintana is their opening day starter.
That was really good last year, but yes.
It's kind of scary.
Let me just check their depth chart here. I'm a big depth chart guy when I have to go look at other teams. Yeah, so it's not super great. They do have Luis Severino, major wild card there. Sean Manaea as well. They're basically the same pitcher almost when it comes to health. And then Quintana and Senga. How long is Senga going to be out?
I think they got a good report on him, and I think he started throwing again. So I think his timetable is
late April,
quicker then. Than they initially thought. Yeah, I think he's sometime late April, beginning of May.
Okay. It's a tough division, but they got a great offense, and they have their closer back. And I just think the Mets will probably do better when the expectations are lower. And they got a new manager, but they get a new one every 2 years, it seems like. So who knows? I don't think Steve Cohen has brought a lot of stability to them, at least in terms of everyone's sanity. But is what it is.
Did you happen to see Red Sox stats on Twitter? They posted the Red Sox revenue for the last 3 years. Did you happen to see that tweet today?
No, I'm dying for you to tell me now.
Okay. So 2021, their revenue was fifth in the league at $434 million. Then in 2022, they were third in the league at $515 million. Last year, they were third again, but it jumped all the way up to $557 million. So when I saw that, my mind went to, like, how can you justify lowering payroll? Like, if you're bringing more and more money in, and since 2021 when they went to the playoffs and 2023, they've increased their revenue by over $100 million. But this year, their payroll is significantly less by like $20 million? Like, how do you justify that? You're making more money. You're bringing more money in, significantly more money, and yet you're just content with not spending. And you don't have a roster that is, like, flawless. There's many flaws in that roster. I just – that drives me nuts. When I saw that today, I was like, anything the front office says is just complete crap. Complete crap.
I'm just looking to see where they are right now. This can't be right.
They're like 20 – I think they're $23 million under the first luxury tax. They're at like 214, I think.
Yeah, I'm on SpoTrack right now, and SpoTrack's saying 162. So they're leaving something out. But everybody's low anyway. Like,
yeah,
the Braves are way lower than where they're at. And
I'm pretty sure 214 is the number after the Bayo extension because it bumped up just a little bit.
Oh, true. Yeah. Yeah. It's frustrating. And that's what I'm kind of clinging to is if we're bad, I want to see empty seats. I want to see revenue go down here. Another thing I wanted to touch on too, and we can kind of wrap the show with this, but when we had Papelbon on in, I think it was in October, or maybe it was late September, he didn't name names, but he essentially said, you know, on the Nesson crew, there was a huge sense of relief that Bloom was gone because, like us, they had the expectation that we're gonna go back to our old identity here and be a big market team again. And he kind of alluded to that. And then the day Bloom got fired, Dave O'Brien, at least twice an inning, would come on and say, in case you missed it, the Red Sox have parted ways with Hein Bloom, almost gleefully at times, like, thank goodness we're going to be better again. And from his perspective, maybe the ratings will get better, because if the ratings are bad, who's the fall guy? It's going to be him. And even though it really should be on the front office for putting a bad product on Nesson anyway. So none of that got alleviated. So I'm hoping there's a little bit of mutiny this year on the Nesson crew. You know, a little bit more frustration. It's hard to do. And the other interesting development is Mike Monaco. It was announced last week that he's the, I forget the way they termed it, but he's the,
it was weird how they phrased it,
the alternate play-by-play guy. Because, you know, that's what O'Brien is. And then whoever he's working with is the color guy, which is obviously usually a player or, you know, some type of expert that, you know, was a part of the game. So I'm wondering if where Monaco's being brought in into that role, and it's probably minimal, it's probably 10 to 15 games at the most. They're putting him there, I think, to keep O'Brien in check. You know, be like, well, you know, if you take some liberties and you say mean things about John Henry, well, here's your replacement. So that was my immediate knee-jerk thing as far as that goes.
And the fans really like Mike Monaco. Like, I think he's very good. I think he really meshes well with Lou Merlone. They just have good chemistry when they announce a game together. But the fans are a fan of him. And if you were to poll Red Sox fans about how they feel about Dave O'Brien, I would probably venture and say that the majority of that poll would not represent him in a very good way, because I think fans think he's boring. And, you know, sometimes I think he gets more excited when the opposing team hits a home run than when the Red Sox hit a home run. Like, it just, I don't know. He's, I don't have a problem with Dave O'Brien, but I know if you go on Twitter, I mean, take Twitter for what it is, but there's a lot of Red Sox fans that don't like him.
It's 50-50 at best for him, and maybe it's 40-60, but he's a polarizing guy. You either love him or you hate him. And when you talk about Mike Monaco and the chemistry, he's just naturally funnier. He's just more relatable. Dave O'Brien's kind of nerdy, and he's got his own kind of nerdy comfort zone, and he's got a great voice and a great cadence, but he doesn't pull you in. He doesn't make you want to keep watching if the game's a blowout one way or the other, if we're way ahead or way behind. And Don Orsillo wasn't this god right away. It took years of evolution to get him there. You know, it wasn't until maybe, I don't know, 2008, 2009, somewhere in there, that he really became the broadcaster he was. And I'm just so impressed with Monaco early on that I would be excited to see what he is in the next 5-6 years and beyond that. It's just funny, and the banter. I just really enjoy him. Even with Euclid, like, I like Euclid better when he's with Monaco. I don't like him as much when he's with O'Brien. And while we're on the topic, it's going to be a very wonky year again on Nesson. You got basically the same cast of characters from last year coming back at about the same ratio, and they need to pick one. I would prefer Merlone. I'm a big Merlone guy. I think he's more relatable. He's one of us, just like Remy was, you know, a New Englander. But if it ends up being Middlebrooks or Euclid, just pick one and go with it so that the chemistry can evolve. I'm just tired of having to constantly get used to the next man up next to O'Brien. I just want normalcy. You always knew it was going to be Remy and Orsillo, aside from maybe a week, because I think they legitimately do have a vacation. There would be like a road trip or whatever, and they'd throw Eckersley in there or someone, or God forbid, Steve Lyons. But he was terrible. He was great in the studio, but not in the booth. I didn't like him.
I think I would be even better if it was just a two-man rotation. I think the three, it's like, especially when Lou is out for a while, it's like, man, when the heck is Lou coming back? Not that I like Middlebrooks. Uke is okay, but I imagine it's challenging for O'Brien to, you know, build that rapport. It's like, who am I talking to tonight? Because it feels like it's a revolving door. So frequently, they just have so many, and sometimes Millar is in there. I don't like Millar in the booth. No offense to Millar, but I'm just not. Other than him calling that home run, he's just a little too much for me. I get so distracted when he's in the booth.
Yeah, I was hoping he would be better because I like him. He's a great interview all the time, but it's like a couple comments about what's going on and then something about 2004, you know,
his golfing endeavors
or that. Yeah. He's not what you would hope. You know, for a guy who's as funny as he is, he doesn't really paint a good picture of what's going on in the game. So, all right, well, I guess we'll wrap it on that. Definitely won't be back till Sunday, but that'll be basically our opening day for the regular season podcast, covering whatever did take place in the Mariners series, and we'll be back essentially to four shows a week. You guys have what, the Oakland series?
Is that? Yeah, I think so. I think that's
the next baby series. That's a nice softy.
When I first started, though, I feel like I did like three or four losing series in a row, like the bottom five, like over and over. And I'm like, is this all I'm gonna do? Because I felt like they were just losing during the week all the time. So it'll be hopefully it'll be nice to talk about a series win. Hopefully.
Yeah, I mean, it shouldn't be. It's relatively soft for a West Coast swing outside of Seattle. I'm getting the schedule up right here. The one thing you guys don't have on the midweek crew is many Yankee series. For some reason, they like those to be on the weekends where, you know, I'm guessing the ratings are a little bit better. Yeah, so you guys have the Athletics, but then you have the first series against the Orioles. So you want to talk about bad series, potentially. that one might not go our way. And then you got the Guardians. Wow, you got the Guardians two midweek shows in a row in April. And then guess who you have after that? You got the Giants. So you might have a depressing month there. The midweek guys got the... Wow, they got the Angels twice in a row. This is a very wonky schedule this year.
I despise when Major League Baseball does that with the schedule. It's like you get the same exact pitching matchups as the week before. It's like, come on, that's 162 games. Be more creative.
I just read this winter, and it fascinated me. The schedule is made every year by a husband and wife team. They do it. They write it all out, and that's insane to me. They must have a computer system. No, they do it by hand, I think. There was something extraordinary about it, so maybe they don't just plug it into a software thing, but because MLB would just do that. But yeah,
how do you get that job?
I don't know.
I want to get that job. What do you do for a living? I build Major League Baseball's schedule. Like, I'm in.
Yeah, that's insane. It probably takes, what, 2 weeks to do that? You probably get.
I bet it takes a lot longer than that, because you gotta think about flying, and you have to have so many divisional games, and now with interleague play, and I bet it's pretty complicated.
True, and if it's longer than a 2.5 hour flight, it has to be an afternoon game per the Players Association. So lots of. Yeah, lots of, you know, parameters or whatever that they have to abide by. And one last thing before I do go. It looks like, it's mostly either super late starts or prime time. You do have a getaway game in Oakland. 2:10 on opening day at Fenway, but... Yeah, I just feel like in recent years there were so many day games, and I was like, come on, I'm so excited for the season to start, and now I can't even watch half of them. But
I know at work, there's nothing I can do. So
yeah,
nothing either. I can do.
All right, well, again, we will wrap on that. Everybody, for most normal people, you're probably listening on your morning commute, so no more sleeps until opening day. We'll be back on Sunday, like we said. Everyone, take care.